Support for this Science Friday podcast comes from EverAlbum. You ever run out of space on your phone? Well, check out EverAlbum, a free mobile app that automatically protects your photos on your phone. You can easily sync your phone's camera roll, Facebook, Instagram, and Dropbox accounts, so your photos are always protected. And now exclusively for Science Friday listeners, EverAlbum is offering unlimited photo storage for free. Yes, for free. Go to everalbum.com/science and download on iOS today.
Support for this podcast comes from 23andMe. Your DNA is made up of 23 pairs of chromosomes. That's where the name comes from. 23andMe is a genetic service where you can get more than 60 personalized reports on your health, traits, and ancestry. 23andMe is the first and only genetic service available directly to you that includes reports that meet FDA standards. Order your DNA kit from 23andMe.com.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. The scene, San Francisco, 1978. A young woman senses there's something not quite right about her boyfriend. A laundromat owner claims his wife isn't his wife. A woman screams that her husband is not her husband.
People are being duplicated, and once it's happened to you, you're part of this thing. It almost happened to me.
That was Brooke Adams in the 1978 remake of the classic flick Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Alien doubles are good grist for Hollywood, but my next guest says that for sufferers of a rare brain condition, feeling like you're surrounded by alien doubles can feel all too real. And that's not the only case where brain biology turns spooky. Sam Keen is a science writer and author of the book The Tale of the Dueling Neurosurgeons, The History of the Human Brain as Revealed by True Stories of Trauma, Madness, and Recovery. Sam, welcome back to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Nice to have you. Let's talk about Invasions of the Body Snatchers. You write that sufferers of something called, Capgras syndrome actually believe their loved ones have been replaced by doubles? Is that right?
Yeah, they basically think that everyone in their life around them, especially people they're very close to, has been taken somehow, maybe by aliens, maybe by some nefarious international conspiracy, and replaced with someone who looks exactly the same, has the exact same voice, but isn't actually that person.
And when you tell them that they just don't believe you, or how do they react?
Yeah, they basically don't believe you. I mean, you can explain to them, and sometimes they'll even agree that, no, it really doesn't make sense that that person would have been kidnapped or whatever happened to them, murdered, whatever. But still, they feel like it must be true. They just, at some level, will not accept the logic that it doesn't make any sense.
So what is going on in their brains at this time?
It has to do with the way we recognize other human beings. When you see a face, for instance, there's really two major things going on in your brain. There's conscious recognition, where you say, aha, I know who that person is. You realize who the person is. And then there's a second system going on beneath that that's more emotional. It's sort of that glow that we get when we recognize somebody. It's happening mostly unconsciously, but it is very important for our recognition of people. When you look at people who are face blind, for instance, if you show them people face blind, meaning they basically cannot recognize anyone else, they are just unable to tell individual humans apart. If you show them pictures, though, of some loved ones, some friends, and then total strangers, as they flip through the pictures, they won't recognize anyone consciously. That's why they're face blind. But if you monitor like their heart rate, other signs of emotional activity, they will still recognize the person on an unconscious level. So they're still getting that glow for the person.
Interesting.
Capgras syndrome, though, is basically the opposite of that. So these people, because of brain damage usually, they are still getting the conscious recognition. They say, okay, I know that person looks like my mother, looks like my daughter, whatever, but they're not getting that emotional glow. In fact, when they look at that person that should be familiar to them, they feel kind of this empty, dead feeling. And that's very scary to them. They don't really know what to do. They feel like that person has been taken away from them. And they feel after that that, well, it can't be really that person then. It must be somehow a double. Somehow that person has been replaced in my life.
Huh. You write about a woman named Madame M, who believed her daughter had been replaced 2,000 times.
Yeah, she was really the first well-recognized, well-documented case of Capgras syndrome back in 1918. And yeah, she thought her daughter had been replaced over and over and over again, because every time her daughter, you know, changed a little bit, maybe got a haircut, lost a little bit of weight, whatever happened, she would think her daughter was a completely new person then. So she kept thinking her daughter kept getting kidnapped over and over again. She also thought her husband was serially kidnapped and replaced as well.
You know, who needs science fiction when you have this stuff, you know?
Yeah.
Your book starts, as I say, with a horror story that is something that happened to you. You woke up and you weren't able to move your body.
Yeah, it's a condition called sleep paralysis, and a lot of people actually do experience it maybe at one point, a couple times in their life. Some of us, unfortunately, experience it on a more regular basis, and I guess I'm one of the unlucky people. Basically, what happens is your mind wakes up, but your body doesn't wake up. So you're sitting there as if you were a statue or something like that. You just cannot move anything in your body, no matter how hard you try to do it. It's really kind of an awful condition to be in.
That only happened once to you?
No, it happens to me often when I sleep on my back. It happens pretty regularly when I do that, actually.
Wow.
Last week, in fact, yeah.
You're not taking any of those sleep medications. I saw one on TV that said that was like a side effect.
Oh, yeah. I could believe it, too. But no, I don't take any sort of medications, anything like that. So, no, it just happens to me over and over, unfortunately.
Now I hear that one woman with sleep paralysis has been declared dead 3 times.
Yes, a woman in England. She actually woke up in a morgue one time because she was that out of it. And, you know, it was a problem for her. I think after that, they figured out not to keep doing that to her. You know,
Check
pretty closely, but it did happen to her.
And some people with sleep paralysis say it's like a demon sitting on their chest or even like alien abduction.
Yeah, what happens basically in the brain is there's a structure called the pons. It's in the brain stem, and that helps control the sleep-wake cycle. And it does a couple things. It sends signals to the higher parts of the brain that might start dreaming going on within your brain. And it also sends signals down to the spinal cord, and it basically temporarily paralyzes your muscles. The reason it does that, sends out chemicals to paralyze your muscles, is that, you know, during a nightmare, you don't want to be jumping up, like taking swings at werewolves or anything like that. It's good for you that your body can't move and react to these things going on in your dreams. But unfortunately, sometimes when you're trying to wake up, the pons will wake up the higher part of your brain to some degree, but it won't turn off the chemicals that are still paralyzing your muscles. And that's what's basically happening during sleep paralysis. And unfortunately for some people, it goes even a step further because their brains don't shut off the dreams as well. So they're awake on some level, their bodies can't move, and they have these fantastical things going on in their mind. And so they interpret them as, say, a witch or something squatting on their chest, or aliens might have them strapped down for some reason to examine them. So that's how their brain makes sense of the experience.
Do you think that some of these real life experiences are the basis for fictional writings or movies or stuff that people will draw from?
Yeah, I have seen scientists suggest that they think that, you know, some people's experience where they really, really feel they were like abducted by aliens or something, it could be a result of this kind of thing happening. So, yeah, it's definitely possible.
You write about a woman named S.M. Why are scientists so fascinated by S.M.?
S.M. came down with a rare disease that killed all of the cells in her amygdala. The amygdala is a structure in the brain involved with the limbic system. It's involved in processing emotions, especially fear. So if, because she lost her amygdala, her doctor said she has basically two black holes where her amygdala should be, because she lost her amygdala, she basically hasn't felt a lick of fear in her life from the time she was a little girl. And the studies about her, I say, are actually kind of a hoot to read about, because basically the scientists are sitting around thinking up, okay, how can we frighten her? What could we do to try to scare her? You know, let's drive her to a haunted house, or I know this exotic pet store that has a bunch of snakes. Let's drive her there and see what happens. So basically they just try to think up ever more elaborate ways to frighten her.
And they did eventually find one way.
They did find one way. All of the early papers seem to suggest that no matter what they did, they could not induce any sort of fear and panic in her. But pretty recently, they tried something a little different. They put a mask over her face that was pumping in air enriched with carbon dioxide. So really, really enriched with carbon dioxide, far more than you would ever encounter in everyday life. And when you're suffocating, you know, when you can't get breaths, a lot of times it's not the lack of oxygen that's making you panic. It's the buildup of carbon dioxide that's doing that. So carbon dioxide really, really pushes a lot of really primitive buttons inside of our bodies. But they just assumed, you know, because she couldn't feel fear for anything else they tried, that she wouldn't respond to this carbon dioxide, this enriched air. But it turns out she did respond to it. In fact, she got really panicked trying to claw the mask off her face. She was really, really freaked out. It was the one thing they found that could frighten her. So what they suggested happened, or what is going on in the brain actually, is that we must have some other sort of independent fear system lurking there that seems to deal with air and making sure that we get a clear, clean air supply. And it kind of makes sense on some level, because air is one of those really fundamental things that all living creatures need. They need some sort of gas exchange with the outside world. So you would want some sort of system in your brain that would make sure you're getting air. And so they think we actually have two parallel fear systems, one that takes care of most fear, but one that involves mostly just the air that we breathe.
Sort of a backup. So if the main system breaks down, you can still breathe.
Yeah, on some level, yeah.
Yeah. And so we learn stuff from these people about how our brains work.
Yeah, that's basically what I was trying to do with the book, was kind of march around from place to place and show you what happens when each part of the brain shuts down. And unfortunately, a lot of these things end up with these really bizarre consequences about people believing about doubles or all sorts of other unusual things.
Now, we're going to talk more. We're going to take a short break and come back and talk about more spooky brain biology with author Sam Keene. It's a great book. It's The Tale of the Dueling Neurosurgeons, The History of the Human Brain as Revealed by True Stories of Trauma, Madness, and Recovery. Boy, just the right stuff for today. We'll take a break and be right back. Support for this Science Friday podcast comes from GE Podcast Theater and Panoply, presenting The Message. How we missed it, no one knows, but now Nikki Tomlin, a PhD in linguistics from the University of Chicago, is working on deciphering it. With her team of cryptologists at a research think tank called Cypher, Tomlin is trying to decode a message received from outer space 70 years ago, or so they think. This new 8-episode sci-fi podcast series blurs the line between reality and fiction, as the famous War of the Worlds radio broadcast did almost 80 years ago. Are we 70 years too late on deciphering the message? Why did the aliens reach out to us? Don't miss any of the details. Subscribe to this podcast from GE Podcast Theater and Panoply, called The Message, on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Again, that's The Message from GE Podcast Theater and Panoply. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. If you just joined us, we're talking this hour about the biology behind some of the brain's creepiest glitches, sleep paralysis, alien hand syndrome. My guest is writer Sam Keene, author of The Tale of the Dueling Neurosurgeons. Let's see if we have time to get a phone call or two in here. Yeah, let's do that. Let's go to Chandler, Arizona. Let's go to Chandler, Arizona, and see if Howard is there. Hi, Howard. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
All right, go ahead.
All right, thank you for taking my call. I was curious about the sleep paralysis. Is there something of a reverse version of that, where your body is not paralyzed during a dream or nightmare?
Hmm.
Well, the opposite of sleep paralysis would basically be sleepwalking. So your body is awake and moving, but your mind is still asleep at that point. So, yeah, that's kind of the opposite of it, sleepwalking.
Mm. There's also something you write about called walking dead syndrome. Dare yes. I ask what that is?
So basically, these people are convinced that they're dead. They are sitting there talking to their doctors. They're moving, they're breathing, but they are convinced that they're dead, to the point where some people claim they can smell their own flesh rotting. A few people have apparently tried to cremate themselves. Like, they are absolutely convinced that they are no longer living.
And you can't put them in a mirror and say, look, you're here. You know?
No, this is one of those things. It's kind of a theme of the book, is that you can explain it to them and be logical about it, but logic just doesn't penetrate at some point when you're suffering from a lot of these delusions. It just doesn't quite get through.
I guess the good news about all these scary things is that they're very rare, right?
They are very rare, yeah. They are well established. We know that these things exist, but they are pretty rare conditions. And usually what has to happen is multiple parts of the brain have to go down at once. It's not like you get a stroke in some little tiny area and suddenly this happened. There usually has to be pretty specific and kind of even extensive damage for these things to take place.
Any idea why Walking Dead syndrome?
That's one of the ones I don't quite know what's going on yet. One theory is, I was talking a little bit before about the emotional glow that we get when we recognize another person. It's subconscious, but kind of an emotional feeling we have. Maybe some people think that, we probably have this emotional glow when we see ourselves in the mirror or something like that. So maybe these people aren't feeling that emotional glow for themselves, and they're interpreting this for whatever reason as the fact that they're dead as a result.
One quick phone call to Ethan in Michigan. Hi, Ethan. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. So my question was, I've heard of this brain surgery, like where they remove half of the brain. It's kind of lobotomy. Can it cause like any of these syndromes?
Yeah, what about...
Yeah, they do that sometimes with severe epilepsy, usually with very young children, because they will have a chance to recover after that. And things like that can cause some anomalies inside the brain. I don't think it would necessarily cause the kind of things we're talking about here, but there are other things I talk about in the book that it does affect.
One other thing I want to get to before we have to leave is called Alien Hand. Alien Hand. What is that?
So if you've
sounds
ever seen
like Dr. Strangelove, you know?
Yeah, basically they think it might have been that in Dr. Strangelove. Or if you've ever seen Adam's Family, a thing running around, that disembodied hand, it's kind of like Thing, except it's attached to your own body. So your own hand, without your permission, will, jump out and grab a pot of boiling water on the stove or grab the steering wheel. There are cases of one hand trying to button up a shirt and the other hand coming along right behind it and unbuttoning the shirt. So the hands are either grabbing onto things you don't want, or they're kind of in active opposition to each other.
And we don't know why that happens.
Well, they have a sense. One thing that might be happening is people's sensory equipment might be getting damaged, so they're not getting the feedback you normally get that tells your brain, oh, I made this movement. So they're not getting that feedback. Mm. And with the other two types, with the opposition and with the kind of magnetic grasping, there's probably something a little different going on in the brain. With the hands going in opposition, when you reach your right hand out to grab an apple or something, your brain is also sending a signal to your left hand saying, okay, you can hang tight for a minute. The right hand has got this. But if certain parts of the brain get damaged, especially the corpus callosum, which runs down the middle of the brain, that signal might not get to the other hand. And so the other hand thinks, well, I want in on this action, and just sort of jumps out and starts doing it.
Wow.
With the magnetic clasping, what's probably happening is there's damage to the frontal part of the brain, which is kind of the executive that kind of tamps down on impulses in the other part of the brain. And when that frontal part gets damaged, your impulse to, say, grab a knife or grab a pot of boiling water, it can't suppress those impulses as well. And so your hand just kind of does what it wants.
Sam Keane, always, always a pleasure to have you on talking with us. Sam is author of The Tale of the Dueling Neurosurgeons, The History of the Human Brain, as revealed by true stories of trauma, madness, and recovery. Some of those you heard today. Thanks again, Sam, for taking time to be with us today.
Happy Halloween.
You too. When you encounter the first spooky spider this Halloween evening, I'm hoping you will have a better appreciation for the eight-legged among us. Because no matter what spider scare someone has for you, it can't compete with the real thing. Let's take the spider's web first. Not all spiders advertise their traps. Some, the cowboys of the arachnid world, actually wait for moths to fly by and sling a sticky yo-yo at them, catching their prey mid-air. Whoa. Others actually fish for their prey. Yeah, some spiders do go underwater. It's a weird world out there once you get to know the ways of spiders, a world of cannibalism. You've got bondage, you have gifted corpses and narcotics, and my next guest has a few tales to spin, so to speak. So next time you see a spider, you won't be spooked. You might be bewitched. Instead, Catherine Scott is an arachnologist and a PhD student at the University of Toronto in Canada. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi there.
Let's start first. A good place to start. One of the strangest spider mating stories, the Australian redback spider.
Redbacks are really cool spiders and have some interesting mating behavior. In the redback spider, males actually actively sacrifice themselves during copulation. So you might have heard of black widows and the idea that the female eats her mate. Redback spiders are a species in the genus Latrodectus, the genus of black widow spiders. And like I said, in this species, the male, as he's transferring sperm, will perform a somersault and offer his abdomen to the female, and she can start snacking on his abdomen as they're mating.
Does she eat everything in the abdomen?
So she does end up killing and completely consuming the spider. But the males of this species have a really great adaptation. So one of the neat things about spiders is that they have paired copulatory organs. So and the female has correspondingly paired openings to her reproductive tract. So he has to mate twice in order to fully inseminate the female. So as he's transferring sperm with his first copulatory organ, the female starts chewing on his abdomen, but he's able to constrict his abdomen in such a way that he sort of compartmentalizes his body so that the female is eating the tip of his abdomen, but the rest of his body is still functional so he can stay alive and survive to do his second copulation. And then once that's done, the female will give him a hug, gather him in, and start feasting away.
I'm sure there's a movie here somewhere. About that. And one of my favorite stories, one of the most endearing spider mating behaviors, is the presentation of a gift.
Some spiders are sort of romantic like that. In two different closely related families called the Pisauridae and the Trecholaeidae. So these are fishing spiders and long-legged fishing spiders. The male of these species will present a gift to the female before mating. And he takes a nice juicy prey item and wraps it up in silk and then presents it to the female, and she'll accept the gift. And as she's feeding on it, the male will copulate. And it turns out that males who provide a gift to the female are able to copulate longer and transfer more sperm than males that don't offer a gift. However, both males and females can sort of cheat at this game. So sometimes the female, if the male doesn't wrap the gift in this beautiful silk gift wrapping, the female might accept the gift, but then run off with it and not mate with him. So if he does wrap it with silk, that helps him to maintain a grip on it so that even if she does try to abscond, he'll just hang on to it and get dragged along with her. And then once she settles down to eat, he'll sort of spring back to life and try to mate with her again. But the males also sometimes what they'll do is they'll wrap up a worthless item in silk and try to disguise it. So they'll take a seed or a prey carcass that they've already fed on and wrap that with silk and present it to the female. And because it's covered with silk, she'll accept it initially and the male will start to mate. But then once she realizes that there's nothing to eat inside, she'll quickly cut short the copulation. Wow. So that's not so great for the male.
So many metaphors I could go with, but I'm not going to go. I'm sure you've thought about them yourselves at one point or another. I'd like to bring on another arachnologist who, yes, has milked scorpions for their venom. Just another day at the office, right, Lauren? Lauren Esposito is curator of arachnology at the California Academy of Sciences in San Francisco. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
How often do you milk scorpions for their venom?
Well, you know, it's not my average day at the office, but it's something that I do fairly regularly.
Well, tell us about the history of arachnids. How far back do they go? Are they all that ancient compared to other invertebrates?
Absolutely. So arachnids are one of the oldest terrestrial arthropod groups. And so what that means is before insects or any other hinged-legged animal walked the planet, at least above the surface of the water, there was arachnids. And so most of the arachnid groups date back to at least 400 million years. And so that's long before the dinosaurs, long before flowering plants. And so they're really an ancient group.
And the scorpions are the oldest?
Scorpions are probably the oldest. So scorpions we're looking at about 430 million years. And these were really monstrous scorpions. They're not like the tiny little cute scorpions of today. They were really monsters. And before they came out on land, they ruled the seas. They were the ancestor of scorpions was a creature called the Eurypterid. And the Eurypterid they're often referred to as sea scorpions because they look quite similar to scorpions. They have sort of a long whip in place of the scorpion tail. And they were the kings of the sea. They ate all the other things that were living in the ocean at the time and then eventually came up onto land as sort of amphibious animals. And what we think they were doing was they were coming up along the shores of rivers and morphed into this semi-aquatic lifestyle where they could come up on land and fish. And so they were probably eating things like salmon.
Wow.
And so you can imagine these like 2-meter-long beasts coming up on the shore to grab salmon. So they were essentially doing what grizzly bears do today.
Wow. We're talking about the spiders this hour on Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International, talking with Catherine Scott and Lauren Esposito. Now, Catherine, I know one of your missions is to convince people that spiders aren't scary. They're not evil. They're not out to get you. And you walk the walk. I actually saw a picture of you letting a black widow crawl on you sometimes.
Yes, I have handled black widows. They're actually very shy, unaggressive spiders that really don't deserve their poor reputation. And yeah, I do a lot of outreach trying to convince people that spiders really have no interest in biting people. Some spiders can hurt people. They're medically significant. In North America, there's only two kinds of spiders that can really hurt people, and that's the widow spiders, and there are a few species of those, and then the brown recluse spider.
So what should you do if a spider, you know, possibly venomous, scorpion, whatever, black widow is crawling on you? Just leave it alone?
So, I mean, if they happen to be crawling on you, the best thing to do would be to just sort of let them continue. And if they just crawl off, then that's great. Or you can sort of try to the way that I get black widows to move around is by gently brushing their hind legs with a soft paintbrush. And so if you're sort of tickling from the behind, they'll walk forward, and then you might be able to convince them to walk off of you. But the chances of having a spider on you are pretty low. Contrary to popular belief, spiders do not go into your bed at night to bite you or try to go into your mouth. That myth that you swallow spiders is totally false.
Unless you're Sean Connery and Dr. No, you don't. you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. but yeah, my main message is that spiders really have no interest in biting people. Unlike a lot of other arthropods, like mosquitoes and ticks and mites that feed on human blood. That's part of their lifestyle. That's what they do. Spiders do not feed on human. They bite insects and other spiders, not humans. So really the only reason a spider would crush you or would bite you, sorry, is if you're crushing it or sort of otherwise harassing it and it feels like it's got no other choice but to try to defend itself.
We asked our fans on Twitter for a few things that scare them in hopes that you can reassure them. Maybe we get through some of them before the break. The legs and the sudden movement, said Eva Amson. That was really a common complaint. Too many legs, you know? Not much we can do about that.
No, and even a lot of entomologists say that extra two legs that's just too many. And people who study insects for a living find spiders creepy just because of that number of legs. And they are the way that they move is also disconcerting sometimes.
Eliza R. says that what really scares her is their ability to disappear. You know, you see one on the wall and you squish it with a tissue. You look at the tissue, spider is not in it, nor on the wall.
I'm not sure what to say about that one. Probably it was a small spider. They can move pretty fast as well.
The same thing happens with mosquitoes.
Yeah, you know, you just got to give a little more pressure. We're going to take a break and come back and talk lots more. Maybe we'll talk about some more of your fears with Laura Esposito, curator of arachnology at California Academy of Sciences in San Francisco, and Catherine Scott, our arachnologist and PhD student, University of Toronto in Canada. Our number is 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Support for this podcast comes from Realty Shares. If you have money in the stock market, you probably broke even this year. Maybe you lost money. But if your dollars were invested in real estate in San Francisco, New York, Seattle, or almost any other major city in the U.S., you likely made money. Diversification is the name of the game, and if you're looking to diversify your portfolio with real estate, look to RealtyShares.com. Realty Shares is an online investment marketplace that allows accredited investors to invest as little as $1,000 per transaction in residential and commercial real estate. Realty Shares is active in over 100 major metro areas. Thousands use their platform to invest in real estate that is sourced and vetted by their experienced professionals. So go to RealtyShares.com/science to create your free account and start investing today. Investments are risky and may lose value. Past performance is not indicative of future results. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking spiders this hour, their unusual, sometimes creepy behaviors, and why you really shouldn't be afraid of them. And, you know, whenever I see a spider in my house, I know it's there for a good reason. I don't want to kill it. So it's doing good stuff. I have two arachnologists on with me today. Catherine Scott, a PhD student at the University of Toronto in Canada. Lauren Esposito, curator of arachnology at the California Academy of Sciences in San Francisco. Lauren, I know that one of the things you're most interested in is venom. And spiders and scorpions are practically pharmacies. You can have hundreds of different drugs from each one.
Exactly. They're sort of venerable pharmacies, so to speak. A given individual spider or scorpion might have 200 unique types of venom that it makes in its sort of venom arsenal.
Wow.
And the really cool thing about those venoms is they're all really specific for particular organisms and particular parts of those organisms.
So could we like farm them looking for new drugs for people?
Yeah, and indeed people are farming them. So there's all kinds of venom components that are currently being researched for their therapeutic properties. Everything from treating erectile dysfunction to treating drug-resistant bacteria.
Tell me about the drug-resistant bacteria.
Right. So there was an interesting study that was released about a year ago. And what they did was they took mice and they infected those mice with MRSA, which is a resistant species of bacteria that's very common in hospitals and poses a really huge problem because it's resistant to traditional antibiotics. Mm. And so what they did was they infected these mice with this bacteria, and then they treated the mice with either a placebo no treatment, or they treated it with this venom peptide. And they found that in the mice that were infected that were then treated with the venom peptide, they were completely cured of MRSA in 4 days.
Wow. 4 days.
Yeah. So 4 days. Astounding.
So where is that drug now?
These things take time. And so that was the first of, I'm sure, many studies that have to be done before it can be fully approved by the FDA. But it's promising research, and it's pointing us in the right direction. And there's similar research being done to treat things like chlamydia, and certain other bacterial infections. But there's also more interesting, perhaps not important, but more interesting therapies for treating things like muscular dystrophy and Alzheimer's.
Wow. But you know where all the money is in these days? It's in that little blue pill for erectile dysfunction. So to hear there's something with spiders about that?
Right. So most scorpions and many spiders have an effect called priapism after they bite you. And so because there's not many spiders that affect humans specifically, that doesn't happen very often. And what priapism means is an erection. It causes blood to fill the cavities of the penis and cause an erection. And so what happens is it's very painful, and you have to take an antivenin. And that antivenin will counteract the effects of the venom. But what is interesting is that it happens, and it's something that's on the minds of many, particularly all those that are investing monthly in their supply of little blue pills. And so what people are researching is how to harness this property of venom peptides and use it for a drug that has little to no side effects. Mm,
interesting. Catherine, let's talk about another spider trick, pheromones. Some of them can be almost like narcotics, right? They can knock a spider out?
Yeah. So that's a story about a spider called Aglaonopsis aperta. It's a funnel weaving spider, very similar to the house spiders that are in a lot of homes in North America, in the same family. And in this spider, males produce a pheromone that they waft over the female with their pedipalps in front of their face, and it causes the female to enter a passive trance-like state. So to us, it looks almost as if she's been knocked out. It's not clear whether it's sort of her decision to become passive or whether this male pheromone is causing her to enter that trance. But once she does, the male is able to sort of haul her around the web, position her the way he wants, and then mate with her.
Wow. We don't think of the spiders having these kinds of powers, you know? What we think about is they have a web, they spin a web, and they catch things in it.
Yeah, well, the really cool thing about spider webs is they're not just for prey capture. Female spider webs actually also function like personal ads, web-based personal ads. So the female has pheromones on her silk that's sending a message to males from a distance and providing him with information about her location, her sex, whether or not she's mated, whether or not she's hungry, which can be really important for males because courting a big female can be risky because some spiders are cannibalistic. They have these really sophisticated scent-based communication systems.
Let's go to the phones to Craig in Tallahassee. Hi, Craig. Welcome to Science Friday.
Good afternoon, Ira and Dr. Scott and Esposito. I recently saw on the internet, of course, a video of somebody's pet tarantula molting its skin. And very, very freaky. You were asking what scares you. That was one of those. It just touched me primally inside how odd this thing worked. I was wondering if all spiders molted. It was very interesting. It came out fully formed with hair and fangs, and the owner said it was still very soft and took hours to harden. But, you know, do all spiders shed their skin in order to grow?
Wow, great question. Thanks for calling. Catherine,
do you want to answer that, Lauren?
Yeah, sure. So indeed, all arthropods molt. It's really interesting in spiders because when they molt, what they're actually doing is growing. So their skeleton is, rather than being in the middle of all their muscles, it's surrounding all of their muscles and containing them, acting sort of as an armor. But in order to grow, they have to get rid of it so that they can grow a bigger one. And so what they do is they actually they shed their entire skin, and not just their skin. This is also their armor, their skeleton. They can't move until it's rehardened. But on top of that, they're shedding their entire digestive system and their respiratory organs. And so during that molting process, the spider is getting a whole new suit, so to speak. And until they've rehardened, it can take several hours. They're really vulnerable, and so they don't want to do it very often. And when they do shed, they need to be in a safe spot. Otherwise, they're going to get eaten.
Sounds like a soft-shelled crab. Sort of the same sort of thing.
Like that.
Yeah. One question to you, Lauren. Back in prehistoric times, that's way back, we had giant ferns, giant dinosaurs, and so on. Were there also giant spiders back then?
There were. There were indeed giant spiders. And so some of the spiders were half a meter in size. They were really, really big.
Half?
The scorpions, maybe.
Let me walk that back a second. Half a meter in size?
Half a meter. Yeah, half a meter. Half a meter spiders. But you have to think, the dragonflies were also a meter big.
So lunch was bigger. So how did they grow so big back then? What allowed them to grow so big?
That's a really great question. So the answer is oxygen. And so because spiders and insects as well typically have passive respiratory systems, which means the way they breathe is they just sort of allow air to pass over their lungs, which are called book lungs. And so they can't breathe in and out like our lungs are. So when they start running too quickly, they have to stop and let the oxygen pass over. They can't breathe harder. And back then, there was a lot more oxygen in the air. And so because the oxygen concentrations were greater, they were able to grow larger because enough oxygen could get to all of their cells.
Wow. Let me ask one last question. What's the thing you want most people to know about spiders that you love but we don't know?
You know, I'm going to talk about arachnids generally and not just spiders because I do love all arachnids. I study scorpions and amblypigeons. And what I'd like to share is that they're cuddly. That's my message. Spiders and scorpions and other arachnids are cuddly creatures. And my evidence for that is that they take care of their young. So scorpions, for example, give birth to live young. The females become pregnant, and when they give birth, the babies come out as small baby scorpions. And the mother will take them up on her back, and she'll take care of them until they get big enough to fend for themselves.
Very cute. Catherine, do you have something we should all know?
So that's a great thing about arachnids that I love as well. I think, my main message is that that spiders don't deserve their bad reputation, that they have no interest in biting you. Bites are extremely rare. I think spiders are a lot more fascinating than scary, and if you learn more about them, start watching their behavior. The behavior is really cool, and they're beautiful. Right. And so,
well, you got us thinking about it today. You certainly got us started thinking about it today. I want to thank both of you, Catherine Scott, a PhD student at the University of Toronto in Canada, Lauren Esposito, curator of arachnology at Cal Academy, as they say, of sciences in San Francisco. Thank you both, and happy Halloween to you.
Thanks
Happy
so much.
Halloween. Thanks for having us.
Snakes. You know, they're not the usual Halloween fare, but our next story, presented for your consideration, is a grisly cross between a Rod Serling tale and an Edgar Allan Poe short story, except it's all true. It's the tale of a snake scientist, a herpetologist, Carl P. Schmidt, who was bitten by a poisonous snake. He did not go to the hospital, but meticulously documented the effects of the bite from the snake on his own body as he slowly died, drip by bloody drip. The rest of the story can be seen in our latest Macroscope video up on our ScienceFriday.com website. Here to tell us about it is a sci-fi video producer, Luke Raskin. Hi, Luke.
Hi, Ira.
Let's talk about this story.
Sure. So Carl P. Schmidt is a famous herpetologist who worked at the Field Museum from roughly the 30s to the 50s. And this is a man that's pretty prestigious in his field at the time. He had many species named after him, and he identified many species. And even though he was very prestigious, He didn't know what species of snake he was handling in 1957 when the Lincoln Park Zoo sent him this small juvenile snake.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, talking with Luke Ruskin and following up on this story. Continue.
Sure. So the snake turned out to be a boomslang, and he didn't really know if it was, you know, he knew it was venomous, but he didn't think it was going to bite him, and then it did.
September 25th, 1957. Page 1. A 30-inch snake brought for identification to the Chicago Natural History Museum from the Lincoln Park Zoo proved to be uncommonly difficult to name. It was known to be an African snake, and with the characteristic head shape, oblique and keeled dorsal scales, and bright colored pattern should have offered no difficulty. But no key for identification would make it a boomslang, for the anal plate was undivided. That it was nevertheless a boomslang, Dysphyllodes typus, was dramatically attested by its behavior. I was discussing the possibility of its being a boomslang when I took it without thinking of any precaution, and it promptly bit me on the fleshy lateral aspect of the first joint of the left thumb. The punctures bled freely and I sucked them vigorously. The mouth was widely opened, and the bite was made with the rear fangs only the right fang entering to its full length of about 3 millimeters. Page 2. 4:30 to 5:30 p.m. Strong nausea, but without vomiting, during trip to Homewood on suburban train. 5:30 to 6:30 p.m. Strong chill and shaking, followed by fever of 101.7 degrees. Bleeding of mucous membranes in the mouth began about 5:30, apparently mostly from gums. 8:30 p.m. Ate 2 pieces of milk toast. 9 to 12:20 a.m. Slept well. Urination at 12:20 a.m. Mostly blood, but small in amount. Took a glass of water at 4:30 a.m., followed by violent nausea and vomiting, the contents of the stomach being the undigested supper. Felt much better and slept until 6:30 a.m. Page 3. September 26th, 6:30 a.m. Temperature, 98.2. Ate cereal and poached egg on toast, and applesauce and coffee for breakfast. No urine, with an ounce or so of blood about every 3 hours. Mouth and nose continuing to bleed, not excessively. Diary ends.
That diary is our macroscope this week. It's the diary of Carl P. Schmidt, the voice of our director, Charles Berquist, the voice of Carl P. Schmidt. It's up there on our website.
That's
Luke,
right.
Luke?
That's right. And if you watch, you can decide if, you know, if Carl P. Schmidt was actually the victim of a snake bite or if something else killed him. Our producer of the video, Tom McNamara, has a theory. You should definitely check it out.
All right, see what you think. Thank you, Luke.
Thank you.
You can watch the macroscope video on our website at sciencefriday.com/snakebite. One last thing. Happy 81st birthday to Bill Siemering this week. He still travels the world with his developing radio partners, helping radio stations in developing countries build up their communication skills. You may not know that Bill invented All Things Considered and Fresh Air, and he gave me my first job in radio. I wouldn't be here if it were not for Bill. Happy birthday, Bill. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. Go to our website at sciencefriday.com. We have a brand new website. It's about a week old. We want you to go there, take a look at all the great things we have going there at sciencefriday.com. Get your reaction and your suggestions. And, you know, you can, if you miss this program, you can also go to our website and point your tablet or smartphone. It looks beautiful, as I say, on mobile, too. So you want to do that and make sure you see it. And one of the things you'll find there is a creature just millimeters in size that looks just like the terrifying monster in the sci-fi thriller Alien. Oh, yeah. It's a Halloween weekend. You can see the real-life monsters and others like it at sciencefriday.com/realalien. Have a great and safe